I'd like to dedicate this morning's shiur Le'ilu Nishmas Mordechai ben Harab Yosef Dov, whose yard site is on Chaf Av. He is the grandfather of our weekly participant, Yonita Wind, and she dedicated the shiur in his memory, as well as in honor of her son Aaron Svi's 15th birthday, which I guess is at some point in the near future. So we hope that her grandfather will have an Aliyas HaNeshama, and that Ari Svi will have an amazing 15th year of his life. And it should be a great year for their family. Be'ezras Hashem, we continue this week our study of Pirkei Avos, and we move on to the second parak of Pirkei Avos. I know we haven't done that in a long time. But to best appreciate the celebrated author of this Mishnah, of the second parak, we're going to spend our time today gaining a full understanding of the Tkufas HaTanoim, of the period, the circumstances in which they lived, to really understand and appreciate the challenges that they were confronted with, all of the different threats that they faced, and all of the different things that they had to surmount. And in doing so, I'd like to begin with the following. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola. If you look in the first parak of Pirkei Avos that we studied over the last long time, you'll notice that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola and much of the passing down, the development, the evolution, the progression of Torah Shebaal Peh is really outlined in the first parak in Pirkei Avos. You'll look there, and you'll find that the first Mishnah is Moshe Kibal Torah Misinai. Moshe Rabbeinu, it all starts with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu accepted the Torah at Har Sinai. He gave it to Yehoshua. Yehoshua gave it to the Zekanim, to the 70 elders. And then, ultimately, they gave it to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. Who were the Anshei Knesset HaGedola? That is a very important question. And why were they so significant? So, just to give a context, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola were at the time of the Shivas Tzion movement. Shivas Tzion movement was after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Klal Yisrael goes into Galus. There they are for 70 years. After 70 years, they were promised from the outset that they were going to have the opportunity to go back, the right of return. Ezra is the Navi at the time. Ezra galvanizes the Jewish people and tries to encourage them to come back to Eretz Yisrael. At the time, he did a very poor job at encouraging them to come back. And the Pasuk says that there were only 10 or 15,000 Jews who were willing to heed the cry. Only 10 or 15,000 Jews who were interested. So much so that when Ezra is on the cusp of going into Eretz Yisrael to try to have this major movement to go back, the movement of return, he faces a problem. He looks at the Jewish community who are with him. He sees who he's surrounded by, and he says, we don't even have enough Kohanim to run a Beis HaMikdash. We don't even have enough Leviim. And he has to turn back around and try to get some more people who are going to be able to help him. So Ezra is the one who really motivated this entire campaign to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Ezra was one of the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. The Rambam says that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola started with Ezra HaSofer. So you have Ezra and Nehemiah. The Rambam writes that Mordechai HaTzadik from the Purim story was one of the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. So there were many, many members. And the last one, the last member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola was, anybody know? Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was the transition. Shimon HaTzadik was the bridge between the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. He was one of the final members who then transitions into the period of the Tkufas HaTanoim. The Teferis Yisrael HaMishnayis, he's one of the most important commentaries on Mishnayis, he writes, why was it so critical? And I put on the back here just for all of us to have a better understanding to see what we're talking about. It's just a chart of who the Tanaim were and the different generations of Tanaim. This, we'll get into it a little bit later, but basically the Teferis Yisrael writes, before the Tanaim, as we just mentioned, we had the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, many of which were Nevi'im. Many of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola were Nevi'im. And the question is, why was this so vital? Why was it so critical that we had a body of 120 members who were considered the Anshei Knesset HaGedola? Why did we need that? And what was the significance of their being there? And he explains the reason why is because Ezra and some of his chaverim and some of his friends, some of his contemporaries were still Nevi'im. So they still lived at a time where there was a concept of Nevuah. But they realized that they were going to be the final of the Nevi'im. Who was the last Navi that ever lived? Okay, so we really need to have a class on like going a little bit further back than the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. The last Navi that ever lived is Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Those were the last group of Nevi'im. Now I see everyone shaking their heads, yes. So I'm glad you all agree with me. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi were the last of the Nevi'im. And this is why. How do we know that? We know it because we know it, but also because Malachi ends off the Sefer, which is the last prophecy that the Jewish people ever have. And he says, he warns the Jewish people, Zichru Taras Moshe Avdi. I'm the last Navi. So I'm the last one who's going to be able to give you clear instructions and clear guidance. And he says, therefore, I'm telling you, Zichru Taras Moshe Avdi. Don't ever forget the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu gave us. That's the foundation of all that we live on. And he gives instructions and he ends off, Hine Anochi Shaleach Lachem Es Eliyahu HaNavi Lifnei Bal Yom Hashem HaGadol VaHanorah. The reason why he says that is because what he's trying to impart to the Jewish people is, I am the last Navi until you will be confronted by Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu will be the next one. So it may be a very long time, it may be a very long gap between myself and Eliyahu HaNavi. And therefore I'm giving you the instructions that in the interim, make sure Zichru Taras Moshe Avdi. That's the way he signs off. Hine Anochi Shaleach Lachem Es Eliyahu HaNavi Lifnei Bal Yom Hashem HaGadol VaHanorah. That's why Malachi is the one who gives over that message, because he's the last Navi that we were privileged to have before the coming of Mashiach. So writes it to Tiferes Yisrael. The Jewish community realized at the time that there's going to be, in the very near future, a reality that the Jews will live in which there will be no more Nevuah. And that was very concerning, and therefore they realized, we have to have a strong body of leadership that is going to take the place of a Navi. When you have a Navi, when you have a charismatic personality that's able to tell you what the Dvar Hashem is, who's able to see into the future, who's able to understand situations that none of us understand, so then that's a very clear guidance. But when you don't have that, what's the alternative? Writes it to Tiferes Yisrael, the alternative is they needed to have a very strong body of leadership, all united and unified together, to lead the Jewish people into this transitional period out of Nevuah, into day-to-day life without prophecy. And that's why the Anshei Knesset HaGadola were so important. Rabbi Reuven Margolius, who has done a lot of work on Torah Shebaal Peh, has in one of his Svarim, when he talks about how the foundation of the Mishnayos and the Gemara were really put together, so Rabbi Reuven Margolius addresses this issue, and he explains in very simple terms why it was so critical that we had the body of people, the body of Talmidei Chachamim, known as the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Let's read it together here in number Aleph. And he says, Yan she'az acharei shnos ha-galus. Here we were, after the Galus, after they were in Bavel. And what happened in the 70 years between the first and second Beis HaMikdash? Look in the Psukim in Sefer Ezra, and you'll see that the Navi describes what the reality was for Jews at the time. There was intermarriage. Everything wrong was going on at the time. It was not a glorious time for the Jewish people. They come back to Eretz Yisrael, so it's a gift. It's wonderful. It's great. But there was very, very poor observance of many of the most foundational mitzvahs. And therefore, Rabbi Reuven Margolius explains, after they now come back to Eretz Yisrael, they had to rebuild, they had to reconstruct anew, they had to restore the Mosad Hazeh Betur Merkaz Kol Chachmei Yisrael. They needed to reestablish once again what it means to have a body of leadership. Here we were in Galus, everyone was fragmented, everybody was all over the place, there was no leadership, and now they come back to Eretz Yisrael and they have to rebuild. And he says this is why the Anshei Knesset HaGadola was so important, which by the way, just as an aside, you'll wonder, isn't it strange? Why do we call it the Knesset? Not why we. Why was it established as the Knesset? For the same reason. Because when they came to Eretz Yisrael, there was an understanding that they needed a strong body of leadership that was going to take the Jews and bring them all together and lead their own country. So in 1948, they named this body, this entity, the Knesset, after the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. That was the idea. Obviously, it's not at all the same. And the moral character of being a member of Knesset is obviously not the same as the moral character of one who was accepted into the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, but the idea was really a paradigm from the generation of the Anshei Knesset HaGadola who came out of Galus, came to Eretz Yisrael, tried to re-inhabit the land and get the Jews back on track. That is what the Knesset had in mind as well. It didn't work perfectly, but it obviously, that was the dream, that was the goal. So here he writes, Lebilti teis makam le'arer, that what they wanted to do was to hold people back from disputing the tradition. Now how can you do that? If I have 120 world-recognized Talmidei Chachamim, who are all sitting together, who are all in agreement on all of the following issues, how is anybody going to disagree with them? You can't have renegade Batei Dinim saying otherwise. We say that this is the way to observe Shabbos. This is the way to observe Yantiv. This is the Minhagim that we observe. These are the Minhagim that we don't observe. Who's going to disagree? 120 of the most prominent people in the world all have signed their name to agree to all of the above. And therefore, that was their idea. That was how they felt they were going to be able to restore and to make sure that people would not fragment into other kinds of divisions, into other kinds of segments of the Jewish people. Go to the next paragraph. Lifnim. Beforehand, Acharei Asher Samach Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Hashalom Es Shivim Azkenim. Think back. You had Moshe Rabbeinu. Again, there were people here and there who questioned the leadership of Moshe Rabbeinu. But on the whole, Moshe Rabbeinu goes down in history as the greatest Jewish leader that ever lived. And he went pretty much unchallenged. Because everybody understood Moshe Rabbeinu learned the Torah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what he was giving over to them was directly from the Ribono Shel Olam himself. So you have Moshe Rabbeinu. But what happens? Moshe doesn't live forever. So what do you do then? And he explains. Therefore Moshe Rabbeinu gave smicha to 70 individuals. And he said, I trust these 70 people to be trusted disciples who are going to carry on the tradition. Now that all works for one generation. Right? You can be close to Moshe Rabbeinu, but how long can you have people who lived in the close proximity, in the same time frame as Moshe Rabbeinu, how long can that live on? One generation, two generations, it's not going to last that long. And therefore the problem was, Efshar Haya Lahara Al Hamatchumim, at the time he said, this generation of leaders that were appointed by Moshe Rabbeinu were beyond reproach. Kasher Ala Moshe Lamarom, V'nestalik Echad Azkenim, when Moshe Rabbeinu dies, they then appointed a substitute. They had a replacement. They had 70 people who stood in the place of Moshe Rabbeinu, who were all trusted by him. And he said, all of that works and all of that is fine, because all of them were considered a continuation, an extension of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now Moshe Rabbeinu dies. And now those 70 individuals die. This happens every generation. It's not a new problem. Moshe Rabbeinu dies, all of his followers die. What do we do next? Next paragraph. Ulam, kasher bishnos galus bavel nistalku harbe mechevri beis adina achrum. When they went into galus, after Moshe Rabbeinu died, they had Nevi'im. So they were carrying on the torch. Then they go into galus. Hinei ba'alosam acharei kein arza. Then they come up to Eretz Yisrael. Hutzrichu lechonein mechadash hamerkaz l'toras Yisrael. They needed to establish one central, authoritative place that would be the voice of the Jewish people. Imagine, had they said, you know, we're going to appoint one person or two people or three people, that would not be sufficient. Why? Because you appointed him, so I appoint him. I believe in this rabbi, you believe in that one, so who cares? I don't care what you say. I follow who I follow who you follow, and we'll all be happy. But that was not going to cut it. That wasn't going to work. Why? Because at the time, there was so much pandemonium, there was so much confusion. They needed to get everyone on track. Well, what's the way to get everyone on track? The way to do it is by gathering all of them to agree to be signed on one body, on one authoritative body. And that is why being the Anshei Knesset HaGedola and establishing this central location helped to solidify and cement and secure the foundations of the future of Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. This really ensured that there would be some kind of perpetuation of all that the Jewish people stood for. Without it, it never would have happened. One of the most foundational principles that was instituted by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola was tefillah. Obviously, there's a mitzvah in the Torah that we're supposed to daven. The Rambam and the Ramban describe that mitzvah, exactly what it means, how many times a day. But there was no text. There never was a text for the davening. It used to be, when a person felt close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when they decided they wanted to communicate something, they went out into the field or they went into the room next door and they offered a prayer. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola are the one who canonized the tefillah as we have it today. They are the ones who wrote and contributed to all the richness of the Siddur that we have. And that really is why the institution of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola was so substantial, it was so significant, and it was so important. As the Rambam explains, the last remnant of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola was Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was, as the Mishnah in the beginning of Pirkei Avos writes, Shimon HaTzadik haya, anybody knows? Mishiyari Knesset HaGedola. Shimon HaTzadik was from the remnants, from the Shirayim, from the Shirai Knesset HaGedola means he was one of the last members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, and he was the bridge into the generation of the Tanoim. So now let's get into the story of the Tanoim. The period of the Tanaim lasted about 160, 170, up to 200 years. That's roughly around how long it lasted. The Rambam writes there are 128 Tanaim that are mentioned throughout the Mishnayos for all different accomplishments, different things. Sometimes they're mentioned for opinions they have, sometimes they're mentioned for stories they were involved with. But there are 128 Tanaim that you can see on the back here and exactly how they are broken down into the different Tkufos. You know, it's interesting when we think back, sometimes we talk about different generations and we have no concept of Jewish history. So we talk about, obviously, people confuse all the time. Sometimes when I talk to high schools, I ask them these questions. You know, I ask, who do you think lived first? The Rambam or Rabbi Yosef Karo? The Shulchan Aruch. What's the answer? The Rambam lived first, of course. And they don't know that. So very often they don't understand. Or when you talk about a machlokas harishonim, so you say, you know, Rashi argued with the Rambam and the Raiva disagreed with the Ramban. They didn't all live at the same time. They were a 500-year tkufa. The tkufas harishonim was not, you know, that Rashi was talking to Rabbeinu Tam every day and the Rambam was a next-door neighbor of the Raivid and the Ramban. It's not the way it worked. They live in different countries, in different places, at different times. And therefore, it's important just to get a context and understand. It's the same with the Tanaim. It was 150 to 200 years. It was called the Tkufas HaTanaim because all of the Tanaim lived at that time period. When we look back in history, it sounds like one sliver of our history, but it was a long time. It was 200 years. 200 years is a long time. I mean, in the context of Jewish history, it's not so long. But that's really what we're describing here. And predominantly, they lived in Eretz Yisrael, and they really contributed in the most significant ways to our Torah Shebaal Peh as we know it today. The problem is that throughout this period of 200 years, they had to overcome so many unbelievable, paralyzing obstacles. When we're going to talk about it, you'll understand, maybe we never thought about it in this way, but you look through the Tkufas HaTanaim, you think about how much they had to overcome, the painful conditions, the torment that they had to endure. It's just completely overwhelming to think about the fact that throughout all of that, they became the Tanaim, and the Mishnah was ultimately written during that time period as well. And that's really what I want to get to. That's what I want to appreciate as we really get into an introduction to the next Mishnah that we're going to study. Let's go through the first overcast, I guess, the first threat that faced the Jewish people at the time in the first generation of Tanaim was actually something that came from within. There were two renegade groups by the name of the Tzdukim and the Baisusim. They were students of the Tanaim. They were students of Tzadok and Baisus, who were the earliest of Tanaim. And they tried to fight off the traditional way that Jews practiced Orthodox Jewry. They were the first reform and conservative movement, basically. Tzadok and Baisus came up with their own ideas of how Jewish communities should run, what they should believe in. Tzadok and Baisus did not believe in Schar Va'onesh. They said there's no such thing. The whole world is predetermined. Why would we have Schar Va'onesh? Now, as we know, this is one of the Yud Gimel Ikari HaEmunah. We believe, like the Rambam writes, that every Jew has the ability to make choices. Every Jew has Bechira Chavshis. And I have the ability to make choices. That also means that I'm going to be punished or rewarded for the choices that I make. If I was unable to make my own choices, why would I suffer a punishment? It's not my fault. If I was unable to make choices, why would I ever be rewarded? I get no credit. God decided that's the way it should be. So what involvement do I have? So those two foundational principles are based on each other. We believe that everybody has Bechira Chavshis, and as a result, we believe also that everybody has Schar Va'onesh. They denied all of that. They denied the concept of Tchiyas HaMeisim, another one of the Yud Gimel Ikari HaEmunah. We believe that there will be a time when Jews will be resurrected, when there will be an experience of Tchiyas HaMeisim. And they rejected all of Torah Shebaal Peh. They said there's no such thing. We observe the Torah as we see it in the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, in the Psukim itself. Anything outside of that, we don't believe in at all. So obviously, that leads to a lot of major differences between the different communities. For example, one prominent example is, when do we start counting Sfiras HaOmer? So what does the Torah say? Svartam lachem imacharas haShabbos. Now we know that Pesach does not always turn out to be on a Sunday. Or, right, the second day of Pesach is not always on a Sunday. So when you're supposed to start counting Sfiras HaOmer, what does that mean? So the Tzedukim believe we have to read the Torah in its literal sense, and therefore Sfiras HaOmer always has to begin mimacharas haShabbos, on a Sunday. Now how do you work that out? However you work it out, you just start counting Sphira on a Sunday. And however that turns out is how it's going to be. Our tradition believes that that's not what the Torah meant. It says, Usvartam lachem imachras ha-Shabbos means, Shabbos in this context does not mean the regular Shabbos. Shabbos here means Yom Tov. Shabbos here is a reference to Pesach. Usvartam lachem imachras ha-Shabbos, you begin, you commence the counting of the Omer after Shabbos. What does that mean? After the first day of Yom Tov of Pesach. So that's one major difference. We're going to be observing Shavuos on different times. So imagine you have some of the Jews observing Shavuos on a certain day, other Jews observing on a different day, and you'll say, well, what's in my business? They're living in their house, they're doing what they want. I'm living in my house doing what I want. What's the difference? Well, obviously it's a tragedy when the Jewish community can't do the same thing. That's one problem. But outside of that, it's much worse. Because they not only did this in private, they actually demanded jurisdiction over the Beis HaMikdash as well. And there was a constant back and forth. When the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, there was a constant struggle over who was going to govern the Beis HaMikdash. They very often were successful in putting in their own candidates to be a Kohen Gadol. So imagine, you have karbanos that need to be offered because today is Shavuos. If it happens to be that this year the Kohen Gadol who's running the Beis HaMikdash affairs is a Tzeduki, then it means Shavuos is going to be on this day. If it so happens that we were able to overcome and we had our own Kohen Gadol running the Beis HaMikdash, then Shavuos was on a different day. So can you imagine? This is the way the Beis HaMikdash is running. This is what's happening. That there's a fight over the leadership of the Beis HaMikdash itself. So this was not just a private issue of how people were deciding they were going to observe the religion. This was far greater than that. This was a fight over the Beis HaMikdash itself and who was going to dominate over the Beis HaMikdash. The truth is, the Rambam writes, that the way the tradition has it is that Tzedukim decided to reject all of Torah Shebaal Peh. The Rambam says they rejected Torah Shebichtav also. They didn't believe in anything. But the Rambam says they knew they would never get away with that. No Jew is going to accept you when you say, I don't even believe in the Torah that came from Moshe Rabbeinu. So they had to tone it down a little bit. They said, okay, we're going to accept the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. We're going to reject everything outside of that, everything that came beyond that. But really the Rambam says in their heart of hearts, they didn't believe in anything. They didn't accept the Torah either. So that's who the first obstacle in the time of the Tannaim was a major obstacle. It was over the leadership of the Jewish people, but that's who they were dealing with. And again, how did this happen? You know why it happened? Because we have, as Reuven Margolius explains, we have Nevi'im. After the Tkufas HaNevi'im, we come to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, who made one authoritative body of leadership that was going to instruct the Jewish people how to behave and how to lead their affairs. Then all of them pass on. We no longer have one authoritative body of leadership, and look what happens. All breaks loose. Everybody goes off on their own. Everybody decides, I believe in this leader, I believe in that one. Nobody likes each other. Nobody can accept the other one. And this is what happens. You can have a leader who stands up and says, I'm also a leader, and I also have followers. And I don't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, nor do I believe in Torah Shebichtav. And guess what? People are going to follow. Because who's going to object? I say one thing, he says another. So I'm entitled to say the way I feel. You're entitled to say the way you feel. And there's no authoritative body that's going to be able to calm down any of these new movements that were emerging. That was number one. And therefore, the Sefer HaKuzari writes, we daven every day the Tefillah of Shmona Esrei. Now the truth is, as all of us know, it's no longer Shmona Esrei. It's not 18 brachos. It is 19 brachos. Where did the last one creep in? Where did that come from? So the additional bracha that was put on later on in history was, again, Shmona Esrei was written, I'm getting a lot of blank faces. I don't know why. Tell me why. Am I saying something wrong? Interesting, I hope. Something. Shmona Esrei was constructed by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. When they put it together, when they formulated it, there were only 18 brachos. In the time of the Tannaim, a 19th bracha was added. What was that bracha? V'lamalshinim al tihisikva. V'chal harisha kerega toved. We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to get rid of all the evil in the world. Writes the Sefer HaKuzari, who is that a reference to? This is who it's a reference to. V'lamalshinim al tihitikva. The objection at the time to these splinter movements in the Jewish community was so strong, there was so much divisiveness in the Jewish community, and it was destroying the fabric of what the Jewish community was about. Not just the fabric of individual lives, it was destroying the fabric of a functioning Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara tells us stories. I mean, the stories are wild. It says that, again, here's another example. If you don't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, what are you going to use on Sukkot as a pre-Eitz Hadar? Torah says, on the first day of Sukkot, you should take a pre-Eitz Hadar, a beautiful fruit. Now, I think certain fruits are beautiful. Other people think something else is. So what's it going to be? How do you decide what you're supposed to take on Sukkot? Torah Shebaal Peh explains to us that when the Torah says that you should take a pre-Eitz Hadar, it means it's a reference to an Esrog. If you don't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, what are you taking? You can take anything. An apple, an orange, star fruit, I don't know. Take whatever you want. So imagine, you come to the Beis HaMikdash on Sukkot. Half the people show up with an Esrog, because they're part of the traditional community. The other half of the community shows up, and everybody has their own thing. This guy's got an orange, and that one has an apple, and the third person over there has a lemon, and this one has a star fruit, and everyone's trying to outdo each other. What kind of religion is that? So much so that the Gemara says there was once a Tzaduki who was running the Beis HaMikdash. He was the Kohen Gadol. He was part of this faction, part of this movement. And this Tzaduki got up and did the mitzvah of Nisach HaMayim the wrong way. He intentionally did it the wrong way. He did not follow the tradition. And it says, Ragmu kal ha'am be'esrogehem. The whole Jewish community started throwing their esrogim at him. So imagine the scene. You have this scene in the Beis HaMikdash. A Kohen is standing by the Mizbeach, trying to do the Avodah, and everybody's pelting him with esrogim. I mean, it's insane. This is what was going on. But that's what was happening because there were fringe movements. And therefore, the Kuzari writes, when they instituted the bracha of Olam Alshinim, this is exactly who they had in mind. This is exactly who they had in mind. I wish I was off the recording for a moment, but there are people who have asked me in the past, and you can plug it into whatever situation you want. Do I ever have a right to daven that a Jew should not be successful? There have been many Jews over the Jewish history, or the last few days, or weeks, or months, who have done very egregious things against the Jewish people. Not in an individual basis. Forgetting about that, I have a grievance against another person. You don't daven that person should be taken care of. It's not the way we operate. But when we're talking about somebody who makes a public statement, a Jewish person who makes a public statement against the entire Jewish community, and it's something that's very painful, and something that's very hurtful, and very damaging to the Jewish community. So many people have asked in the past, do I have a right to pray for their... We never pray for somebody's demise. The Gemara says that in the days of the Tanaim, Rabbi Meir was so bothered by the people who used to drive him crazy. So the Gemara says that his wife caught him, that he was davening that they should die. And his wife, Buria, who was a very righteous woman, Buria turned to him and said, that's not proper. We never daven that somebody should die. That's not the right thing to daven for. So you don't like them, and they're driving you nuts, and they're destroying the Jewish community, okay? So you daven that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should show them the light, that they should turn around in their lives and become back on track. She learned that from a pasuk. The pasuk says, Yitamu chataim min ha'aretz u'rshayim e'od einam. What does that mean? Let's translate the words. Yitamu chataim min ha'aretz means, it's a tefillah that we say on what day of the year? Baruch Hinafshi. It's the last pasuk in Baruch Hinafshi on Rosh Chodesh. So once a month, if you get to the end of the davening on Rosh Chodesh, and you get to the end of Baruch Hinafshi, those are two major assumptions. If you get to the end of the end on Rosh Chodesh every month, you will see this pasuk there, where it says, Yitamu chataim in ha'aretz, we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu that sin should be obliterated from the world, u'rishayim od einam, and therefore, once sin is taken away from the world, there will no longer be rishayim. So what are we asking for? We're not asking that the Rishayim should be destroyed. We're asking that sin should be destroyed. And that means you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, should enlighten the eyes of the Rishayim that they should no longer do sin, and then our world would be a much better place. That's what we daven for. So when we say in the Bracha V'Olam Alshinim, what are we asking for? We're asking that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should do something to those people who are causing harm to the Jewish community. So there are many people who think about this in modern day Jewish history as well. There are some people who make decrees that are very, very evil toward the Jewish community, toward the religious community, very oppressive. And the question is, what is our reaction? What is our response? Do we say, well, just because they're Jews, therefore, you know, whatever they do is fine? That's obviously not a proper approach. Just because a Jewish person does something doesn't mean it's fine. And just because a non-Jewish person does something doesn't mean it's not fine. There are plenty of righteous non-Jews and plenty of horrible Jews. Works in both directions. But that being said, I told them that the Sefer HaKuzari writes, when the original institution of Olam HaShina was written, it was targeting Jewish people themselves. It wasn't targeting the enemy who was outside of the Jewish community. The Olam HaShina was written to target those Jews who were causing trouble in the Jewish community from within. So that just gives us a little bit of an understanding as to what it is that we're dealing with. So that was the very first impediment that really faced the Tanaim at the time. And that was a very, very painful time in Jewish history, not only because of everything we just described, but here, take an example of where it went so much further than just a religious dispute. It was not just about who's the real religion, and who are the authentic ones, and who has a right to lead the Beis HaMikdash, and who has a right to follow Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh. It went far beyond that. How did it go far beyond? Because one of the painful consequences of that was, there was a Jewish king by the name of Yanai HaMelech. Have you heard of Yanai HaMelech? Someone? Anybody? No. Okay. Yanai was a Jewish king at the time. Thank you. All the way from Farakoi. Somebody shakes their head. So, Yanai HaMelech was a Jewish king at the time. And Yanai HaMelech was very enamored by the movement of the Tzdukim. Yanai HaMelech thought that they were correct. Yanai HaMelech believed that these renegade Jews who decided to make and create their own movement were correct. So what do you do when the king takes the side of the underdog? And most of the Jewish community is not following that. Well, the problem is that's really dangerous. And the king decided, he was so upset at the Prushim were the traditional Orthodox Jews, which by the way is a strange way to call them. What does it mean to be a Parush? To be a Parush means to separate myself. Now, one second, we didn't separate ourselves. They separated themselves, right? The Tzdukim are the ones who went off. We were the ones who stayed the same. So why were we called the Prushim? That was a derogatory name that they gave us. They said, you are the Prushim. That was part of their campaign. It's all about the marketing. Part of the marketing was, we are the Jews, and they are the ones who broke off. So we, the traditional Jews, who always followed the same law and the same rules, suddenly became known as the ones who broke away. Now that plays with people's minds. It starts to say, hey, that must be the non-authentic religion, and this must be the right thing. So it was a derogatory name that was given to the traditional Jews, but it stuck. So Yanai was so upset at the Tanaim of his generation because they were not going along with these new fangled movements that were being created. And he felt very strongly that they were correct. So Yanai HaMelech decides that he is going to do something about it. What does he do? He threatens the lives of all the Tanaim. Not only does he threaten them, he kills all of the Tanaim who lived at the time. And the Gemara says that he destroyed the most prominent of Talmidei Chachamim and the most prominent leaders at the time. The Gemara says a very strange Shalom Bayis issue, that he was married to a woman by the name of Shlomtzion Hamalka. So Yanai had a wife by the name of Shlomtzion. Sounds like a wonderful couple. They were pretty evil. But Yanai just murdered all of the Talmidei Chachamim. Little issue. Shlomtzion's brother was a Tana. Shlomtzion's brother was one of the Tanaim. His name was Shimon ben Shetach. Anybody, right, we're familiar with that name? Shimon ben Shetach was the brother of Shlomtzion. So what do? Your brother-in-law is murdering all of your friends. And you're afraid for your life. You're going to be next. So Shlomtzion promises her brother she's going to hide him. How nice. So she hides her brother and figures out a way for him to remain alive, even though her husband was threatening to kill everybody and successfully killed everybody. The Gemara then says the craziest end to the story, which was Yanai ends up making a major party. And actually, if you want to see, I'm appreciating that somebody's looking at the back, you can find all of these names here. You can find everybody on the back here, right? We're talking about Shimon ben Shetach. You can find them on the back as well. Anyway, so the end of the story was that he makes a big celebration, a big party after this is over. Why is he celebrating? He's celebrating because now he overcame the opposition. He wiped out all of the Tanaim, and there's no longer going to be a future of traditional Jews. Tzedukim are off to a great start, and we're okay. So it sounds all nice. Comes to the end of the party, and Yanai says, hey, we have a problem, you know? I just killed every single one of the Talmidei Chacham in the generation. Who's going to teach us how to bench? How are we going to bench? This is a problem. Now, in my opinion, I would say that's a strange thing to be worried about. Lo sirtzach, you just murdered hundreds of tanaim, not a problem. But after you make a celebration and you're stuck by the benching and you don't know how to read the words, now you got a problem? You're sick in the head. I mean, there's something wrong with you, but your priorities are insane. So he was very worried. So Shlom Tzion says, I have a great idea. I think there's one person I can find who might know how to bench. But I'm only going to take him out of the woodworks if you promise me that he's going to be safe. So he says, I want to bench so badly, I'll take anybody. So I'll make whatever promise you want. So she says, really? I want it in writing. So he promises that whoever she's going to find who's going to know the benching, he's not going to kill him. Out of nowhere, Shimon ben Shetach shows up, her brother. And Yana is in for the shock of his life. Where did you come from? How did you survive this massacre, this pogrom? And he says, well, your own wife hid me in the closet. So I've been here all along and she's been taking care of me. And meanwhile, he's the one who's taken out to bench. It's a crazy story, but that's what the Gemara tells us. But that was one of the horrific physical outcomes that came about as a result of this movement of the Tzedukim. So again, Tannaic period in history sounds like a glorious time in Jewish history. This is only the first of the tragedies. This is only the first of the obstacles that they had to overcome. Somehow they prevailed. Somehow they were able to rebuild, which bring us to then the third generation of Tannaim. If you look at the back of this, you see it's broken down. Dar Rishon, Dar Sheni, Dar Shlishi. So we come to the third generation of Tannaim. What happened in the third generation of Tannaim? There was another catastrophic event that took place. Now again, we're just coming off the heels of fighting off the Tzedukim. And that was a battle that went back and forth. As a result of that, all the Tannaim are basically murdered. It takes time to rebuild the Jewish community. It takes time to once again have leadership the way it's supposed to be. That doesn't happen overnight. So finally they get themselves back on track. There are Tannaim being produced, yeshivas are going on, things are going okay, and then they face the tragic catastrophe of Churban Beis HaMikdash. Second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. So that's the next obstacle that they face. And that's a tremendous problem. The Beis HaMikdash was the epicenter of Jewish life. We don't need to go into the details, we all know. We're still commemorating Tisha B'Av because we still feel that there's something lacking by not having a Beis HaMikdash. It shows us what that obviously meant to the Jews of that generation. It's hard for us to really understand fully what it meant. It's hard for us to really appreciate what a Beis HaMikdash was and how central it was and how much it meant to the Jewish people and what losing it really signified to the Jewish people at the time. But that was the second major obstacle in the times of the Tannaim. And the leader at the time, right after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, was none other than Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the Nasi at the time. And he now is challenged with trying to explain to the Jewish community how they're going to live without a Beis HaMikdash. This is not simple. This is a whole new way of life. Now we're going to have to reinvent everything that we've done. We have to change all of our assumptions. Everything needs to be new. Everything needs to be reevaluated. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made many institutions for the Jewish community, some of which we don't even realize are institutions. We just take it as normal practice. But he did them because he didn't want us to forget the fact that there was once a Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sees the Churban, he experiences it, and he says, the problem is going to be, Jews are going to be in exile for thousands of years now, and they won't even remember what the religion was like when there was a Beis HaMikdash. So he makes all kinds of institutions. One of them was, the Pasuk says, on Sukkos, Ulokachtem lachem bayom harishon pre-eitz hadar kapos tamarim. Right? So you have to take, on the first day of Sukkos, bayom harishon, first day of Sukkos, you take the Dalet Minim. Simple enough. Can I ask anyone in the room, how many days of Sukkos do you shake the Lulav and Esrog? One? No. Why not? I don't know. Well, the Torah says only shake it on the first day. So why do we shake the Dalet Minim the entire Yom Tov? We've never asked the question because whoever thinks about it. But go back to the Psukim and ask yourself, why do we do this? Well, the answer is, there's two different mitzvahs. The mitzvah is that if you live outside of the Beis HaMikdash, outside of Yerushalayim, you only shake the Dalet Minim on the first day of Sukkos. There's a separate mitzvah, and that is, if you are in the confines of Yerushalayim and by the Beis HaMikdash, you shake the Dalet Minim every day of Yom Tov. Yochanan ben Zakkai came around and he said, you know what's going to happen? We're going to be in exile for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years, however long it's going to be. No one's going to remember that there ever was an idea of shaking the lulav every single day of Sukkos. No one's going to even imagine there was such a thing. And he said, we're going to make an institution in order to remind everybody that there's such a thing as mitzvahs that were done differently in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. We're going to remind them and we're going to institute that this is how they're going to do it all over the world. And it's only Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai who came up with this idea that we should shake lulav every day of Sukkos instead of just one, to remind us of how things were in the days of the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara goes through many takanos that he made at the time to try and encourage people to think about Churban Beis HaMikdash and to think about what life was like. Now, it may not have been so successful because it became so part of the standard practice that we do that we don't even think about Churban Beis HaMikdash anymore. We don't think about the original of how it was and how it is today. But that was the original intent. That was really what it was for. That was the third generation, and that's what they had to overcome. That's what they had to deal with. Okay, you move on a generation and you say, okay, this generation never knew the Beis HaMikdash. They were not familiar with what that was like. So okay, we're in a better place. We come to the next generation, and by far the towering giant, the dominant personality of that generation was Rabbi Akiva. Now Rabbi Akiva was an amazing one of the Tanaim. He actually learned by the students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So over here you just see the chain, direct chain, of how things continued on and how they moved from one generation to the next. Rabbi Akiva, as we know, built yeshivas l'shem l'tiferes, and the Gemara tells us he has 24,000 Talmidim. And we're all familiar with this Gemara in Yevamos. 24,000 Talmidim, can you imagine? How does somebody build an empire of 24,000 Talmidim? And yet Rabbi Akiva, 24,000 students, the Gemara says, all of them died bein Pesach l'Atzeres. You understand what that means? 24,000 people dying in a span of a month? A little bit more? A little bit more than a month? That's like 700 or 800 Levayas a day. All of them from the same community. It's not 700 or 800 Levayas a day from different places in the world. It's 700 or 800 funerals a day in the same town. It's 700 or 800 families of Yisomim every single day. And Almanos every single day. We don't think about it in that way, but imagine what that means. Catastrophe. So much so that the Gemara says, after that was over, Haya ha'olam shamim. The world was empty. 24,000 of the leading personalities, every single one of them died in such a short span. So, as if Misas Talmidei Rabbi Akiva was not enough, as if the death of this entire generation of students and future leaders was not powerful enough, Rabbi Akiva is then faced with another unbelievable story in his time. Bar Kokhba. The Bar Kokhba revolt happened in the days of Rabbi Akiva. Who was Bar Kokhba? Bar Kokhba was an extremely charismatic person, an extremely talented person in the days of Rabbi Akiva. He became known as Nisi Yisrael. He was the leader of the Jewish people. For all intents and purposes, everybody believed in him. The Talmud Yerushalmi writes that Rabbi Akiva said about Bar Kokhba that he was the Melech HaMashiach. Rabbi Akiva was totally convinced that this person is the Mashiach. Now the Rambam says, how is that possible? Are there no signs to identify who the Melech HaMashiach is? Rabbi Akiva wasn't stupid. Rabbi Akiva understood. So how could it be that you made a mistake? How could it be you believe this person is Melech HaMashiach and then it turns out he's not? Right? Is it wrong for somebody who believes that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was Mashiach when he was alive? It's wrong to say that he's Mashiach now. He's not here. But is it wrong for somebody to believe that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was Mashiach when he was alive? there were plenty of people throughout the generations who believed that their leader was Mashiach. Rabbi Akiva is not faulted for believing he was Mashiach, and the Rambam says, Mashiach has to be a person who has great qualities, who knows how to be a leader, who impresses the Jewish people in many different ways. But the Rambam says that he doesn't have to do osos umovsim, he doesn't have to do miraculous things. So Rabbi Akiva identifies a person who is completely charismatic, who is the leader of the Jewish people, who has an amazing personality, who really knows how to do things right, who has great midos, and he says, this man seems to me like he's the Melech HaMashiach. I don't know, sounds to me like the Lubavitcher Rebbe could have been that also. Why is that? Meaning, just to bring it down, some people are very antagonistic about the whole movement. Again, you should be antagonistic about the movement now, because now it makes no sense to say he's not here, he's not alive, which is exactly what the Gemara says. They were convinced Bar Kochba was Mashiach until he died, and then they realized, okay, I guess we were wrong. He can't be Mashiach once he's dead. It's clear. The Rambam says, if he dies, he's out. You're out of the running. Makes sense, right? Makes a lot of sense. Mashiach has to be alive. So, the movement itself is something that was done many, many times, and it's a dangerous movement. Why? Because what happens when that leader dies? What happens if you're wrong? You convince an entire generation, Mashiach is here, this is the Mashiach, and then it doesn't pan out. So then what? Then people lose faith. And they say, well, if you promised me this was the Mashiach, and now he's not here, and it didn't turn out to be the way you said, so now I'm stuck. That's the challenge, that's the problem. But the whole idea, the whole concept, is something that already existed in the days of Rabbi Akiva. Why was he called Bar Kochba? That wasn't his name, right? At his bris, you think they said, V'yikari Shmo B'Yisrael Bar Kochba? That's not his name, no. What was his name? His name was actually Bar Kuziba. It's also a strange name. V'yikari Shmo B'Yisrael Bar Kuziba. It's the same strangeness. Why is he called Bar Kochba? Because the reference to Mashiach in Chumash is when the Pasuk says, Darach Kocho Me'Yakov. That it says there's going to be a star that is going to come out of the Jewish people. And that star, tradition has it, is a reference to Mashiach. That's where in the pages of Chumash we find the only reference to Mashiach. So everybody was so convinced at the time that Bar Kuziba was Mashiach, they called him Bar Kochba, the one who is the star. What were they referring to? That pasuk in Chumash that says the star is the Melech HaMashiach. So what happens? Bar Kochba is leading the Jewish people, he's galvanizing them, and he says, we are going to fight against the Romans. We are going to have a revolt, and we are not going to give in to the oppressive conditions that they want us to live by. Rabbi Akiva supported this. Why? Because Rabbi Akiva said, this is the Melech HaMashiach. That was a terrible mistake. It was a horrible mistake, and the Gemara says the first couple of years, everything was doing very well, the revolt was actually working, they were very successful, and people said, oh, you see, he must be the Mashiach, it's really working. 1 year, 2 years being very successful, it must be that we're on the right track, until everything turned, and the Gemara then describes that it was a devastating outcome. Tens of thousands of Jews were killed as a result of this uprising, and in the end, the Gemara and the Midrashim give unbelievable descriptive details about, it says that nobody had to fertilize their fields for years and years afterward because there was blood streaming through the streets for years afterward. Obviously, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it gives us a picture of what was going on. The Gemara says that houses were swept away in the blood, houses that were made of huge rocks and huge stones because so many people were killed. And one of the terrible things was that at the time, the Roman Empire did not allow for those people who were murdered to be buried. And they said, you tried to make a revolt, you lost, we're going to show you the price you're going to pay for what you did. And we're not going to allow you to be buried. So here you have hundreds of thousands of Jewish bodies that are being piled up all around the community, the Gemara says, and they're not allowed to be buried. How long did this go on? The Gemara Maseches Gittin writes, 7 years. 7 years, imagine. I just read an article yesterday about the last victim of Surfside that was buried. And the family members were saying how it's been over a month. Can you imagine? Over a month we don't have closure. Over a month we couldn't bury this person. Over a month we couldn't identify. Imagine? 7 years? 7 years? And bodies being left around the streets in piles all over the place? We all understand how gruesome that is. We all understand how horrific that is. Which leads us to a pasuk in this week's parsha. Parsha Sekev, the Torah tells us, we have a mitzvah, ve'achalta ve'savata ve'rachtas Hashem Elokecha. We have a mitzvah that after we eat bread, we're supposed to bench, Birchas HaMazon. What is the text of Birchas HaMazon? Look through the pages of Chumash in this week's parsha, you won't find it. It just says, you should bench. Now what am I supposed to say? How should I bench? What is one supposed to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for? What am I supposed to thank him for? So, the Gemara says that this really came about in four different stages. Birchas HaMazon, as we know it today, did not happen at one time. It came about in different stages. Let's look together at the bottom, number Gimel, where the Gemara says the following. Amar Rav Nachman, Moshe tiken leYisrael Birchas HaZan. You know when you say the bracha HaZan HaSakol? Moshe Rabbeinu instituted that bracha. Moshe Rabbeinu wrote it. He was the author. When did he write it? Well, you have man coming from heaven every day. It's taking care of sustaining the Jewish people. Moshe Rabbeinu says, we got to say thank you. We have to say something. So he says, thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaZan HaSakol. You are the one who takes care of everybody. You give food to everybody who needs. Okay, that's bracha number one. What comes next? Well, the Gemara says, Yoshua ben Nun, when he goes into Eretz Yisrael, he instituted the bracha, Noda Lecha. Thank you so much, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ala Eretz v'ala Mazon. Thank you for giving us food. And thank you for giving us Eretz Yisrael. We're so lucky to have a country, to have a land, to be here. Finally, Yoshua ben Nun gets to bring the Jewish people in. So you have Moshe Rabbeinu writes the first bracha when the man falls. Yoshua ben Nun writes the second bracha when they enter into the land of Eretz Yisrael. What comes next? The Gemara says, David and Shlomo have the opportunity to inhabit Yerushalayim. They identify the place that is supposed to be designated, destined for the Har HaBayis. And they go ahead and Shlomo builds the Beis HaMikdash. So David writes the part of the bracha al Yisrael amecha va Yerushalayim mirecha. Shlomo writes al Habayis hagadol ve'akadosh, and that is when the third bracha of Birchas HaMazon was instituted. Now, as we know, Yerushalayim has been destroyed since, so that's where we change the bracha a little bit and we say uvenei Yerushalayim. We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rebuild. Obviously, Shlomo and David HaMelech did not say that. David and Shlomo built Yerushalayim, so they didn't ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to build it. We added that on later. And the fourth bracha is what? Hatova HaMeitiv. That's the fourth component to Birchas HaMazon. What is that all about? B'yavneh tiknuha. That came along later in the days of the Tanaim. Kineged haruge beitar. What does that mean? All of these Jews that were killed in the Bar Kokhba revolt, all of those that suffered the consequence, whose bodies were outside, forbidden from funeral, forbidden from being buried, also hayom shednidnu haruge beitar lekvura. Imagine a new king comes into reign, and he gives instructions, he gives orders, we're allowing the Jews to bury the bodies. Can you imagine the simcha? Can you imagine how the Jewish people felt that finally they have a right, finally they have the ability to do what any natural, normal community would have done? To bury the dead? Tens of thousands of people. The Gemara says on that day, they were so excited, they wrote this bracha of Hatova HaMeitiv. They added a new bracha to the benching. They said, every time we bench and we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us food, we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us Eretz Yisrael, we thank the Ribono Shel Olam for giving us Yerushalayim, we now also need to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us this opportunity to bury the dead. Amazing. So the Gemara says, HaTov was the fact, Shelo Hisrichu. 7 years, all of the bodies were intact. 7 years, it was an open miracle. 7 years, the bodies were intact. And we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us the opportunity to bury all of these people who were killed. As if we haven't yet heard enough about the lifetime of Rabbi Akiva, and all of this happened so far. What was the end of Rabbi Akiva's life? He was one of the Asara Haruge Malchus. So the Gemara tells a story, and the Midrashim really expand on it. There was a Roman Caesar who made up in his head that he was going to make sure to somehow get back at the Jewish community for selling their brother Yosef. Now, why did he care about Yosef? He didn't really care. He just needed a good excuse. So he calls in all of the Chachamim one day and he says, I have a question for you. What is the halacha if somebody murders another human being? What do you do to them? They all unanimously answer, we take his life. He's a menace to society. We can't have him alive. He deserves the death penalty. So he turns to them and he says, I don't understand. Many years ago, there was a Jew by the name of Yosef HaTzadik. You guys tried to kill him. His 10 brothers tried to kill him. How come nobody ever went back and said they should be punished? So I have an idea. I'm going to avenge the blood of Yosef HaTzadik. I'm going to take the 10 greatest Jewish leaders that we have alive today, because they are probably somewhere comparable to the Shvatim. That's the best I'm going to get. And I'm going to take the 10 greatest Jewish leaders, and I'm going to kill them on behalf of Yosef HaTzadik. That's what he does. Look at the bottom. We say in the Piyutim on Yom Kippur, Ayei Avoseichem Asher Achichem Machruhu. Where are your fathers who went and sold their brother and tried to kill him? La'orchas Yishma'elim Sachruhu. They sold him away to a group of Muslims, to a group of Arabs, Va'atem, and all of you, 10 of the greatest leaders of today, Kablu Din Shamayim Aleichem. I want you to accept all that God has said is going to happen to you. Ki mimei avoseichem lo nimtza kachem. There have never been 10 great people like all of you who are here today. V'im hayu b'chayim. Obviously, if the Shvatim were alive, I would prosecute them. But they're not here. So in their place, I'm going to take 10 of you. Va'atem tisu avon avoseichem. And you are going to avenge the blood of Yosef HaTzadik and take the place of the punishment that he and his brothers were supposed to suffer. That is the tragic end of Rabbi Akiva and his contemporaries. If I were to sum up the Tkufas HaTanaim in just 1 hour, which we just did, what would you say? Tragic. Horrifying. So yes, they were in Eretz Yisrael, they had a Beis HaMikdash, all was great. All was not great. All was horrible all along. And one generation of Tanaim after the next, for 200 years, one after the other, has to overcome these tremendous hurdles, these unbelievable obstacles, which, I'm going to leave a cliffhanger, leads us right into the amazing prince of all of Torah Shebaal Peh, who we are going to learn about next week, who was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. We'll see everybody next week.